Muir goes into the post office and investigates the humour of the subject with the help of Alfred Marx.
Alfred, there's a man on the phone selling clothes props.
Ask him to hold the line. The telephone rang. The new Irish maid picked it up, muttered a few words into it, and slammed it down. Her boss said, "Who was that? I'm expecting a very important phone call." Or she said, "It was some idiot, Mr. O'Hara. He said it was a long distance from Sydney, Australia." I told him, "Sure, and we know that."
Oh?
Yeah?
Why did you become a telephone linesman?
Well, my last job was sending me up the pole.
Hello, hello. Is that McPherson, McPherson, McPherson and McPherson, the solicitors?
Aye.
Could I speak to Mr. McPherson, please?
I'm sorry, he's away on holiday.
Oh. Oh. Could I speak to Mr. McPherson, then?
I'm sorry, he's with a client.
Well, then, could I speak to Mr. McPherson?
Aye, speaking.
Yes, another Irishman went to see his friend in hospital. The poor man's lying there with bandages round both his ears. "Oh, Mickey," said, "what happened to your ear?" "Well, Paddy, you see, somebody phoned me up while I was doing the ironing." "Oh," he said, "well, what about the other ear?" "Oh, that was when I phoned for the ambulance."
The post office, with its postal and telephone services, performs the valuable function of bringing people together. But like so many worthy institutions, it's often the butt of humour. Sometimes the humour is aimed at genuine inefficiencies in the system. Often it derives just from the character of its users. And some people are less keen than others on being brought together. Henry David Thoreau.
"For my part, I could easily do without the post office. I never received more than one or two letters in my life that were worth the postage."
The bearers of bad news have always been unpopular. In classical times, they tended to be executed. Nowadays, the GPO is just made fun of. The postman is held responsible for what he delivers. Douglas Jerrold.
"The strange volume of real life in the daily packet of the postman, eternal love and instant payment."
The poet William Cowper drew attention to the postman's lack of involvement in his burden.
"He whistles as he goes, light-hearted wretch, cold and yet cheerful, messenger of grief perhaps to thousands and of joy to some."
All very unfair, isn't it, on the poor postman? Let's return to a time when their work was appreciated. The historian Herodotus wrote in their praise in the 5th century BC,
"Neither snow, nor rain, nor heat, nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds."
And after all, is it so very different today?
Morning.
Oh, good morning, postman.
Is it? It's only for those who don't have to work.
You're new, aren't you?
I am, and I don't like this street for a start. All fancy names, no numbers. Middle-class bourgeois decadency, that's what it is.
Is it?
Snobs, all of you. Too posh to give the houses numbers, ain't we? Dun Roman, Belly Vista, the Warren, and this fiasco you live in, Windsor Castle.
I'm entitled to call my house what I like.
You don't have to have your standard flying from the flagpole, do you?
Just to let people know I'm in residence.
Well, I don't hold with it.
Now, look, supposing you give me my letters and be about your business.
Is this 24?
No, it's 23.
Oh, only I've got a registered letter here for them, you see.
24, that's right, yes.
Got a sign here, will you?
Robinson, yes, yes. Any more?
Oh, I think so. Where are we? Let's have a look in the old bag. Let's see, Windsor Castle, Dun Roman, Beggar's Roost, Limebourne. Where's Belly Vista?
Down the road, you passed it.
Oh, well, I'm turning it in here. I don't have a lot. I'm going on strike.
Well, I don't want all these. What am I going to do with them?
You do what I always do. Put not known on them and shove them in the pillar box.
That was Tony Hancock. The interesting thing was the other part of the postman was played by Alan Simpson, who was 50% of Galton and Simpson, who wrote Hancock shows. Rather good, isn't it? The most common source of anti-GPO humour is the time it takes letters to reach their destinations. Here's a letter sent to the Times in 1970 by the Dean of Canterbury.
"Sir, A few days ago, I received a communication addressed to T.A. Beckett, Esquire, care of the Dean of Canterbury. This will surely be a record in postal delays, Arthur.
But this kind of cavilling ignores the many advantages of the British postal system. Here's an unexpected one, discovered during the last war and reported in the Daily Telegraph.
After waiting 6 days for a passenger boat, Major L. Palmer travelled from Guernsey to Jersey in a Channel mail steamer as a parcel, bearing a label marked OHMS and accompanied by a postman.
And yet, in spite of these abuses, the GPO is still ready to help the humblest correspondent, be he or she only a child. A report from the News Chronicle.
The Post Office Foreign Mail section announced that if a child puts a proper stamp on a letter to Santa Claus in Greenland, Iceland, Denmark, Switzerland, Finland, or any other foreign country, it's forwarded to that country. The spokesman added, of course, we know that Santa Claus don't live in those places, but what happens when they reach the various countries? We don't know.
If the GPO only dealt with the postal services, they could probably put up with the occasional ill-informed jibe. Unfortunately for them, they also look after the telephone system and are thus open to humorous jibes on two fronts. Now, the creation of the telephone was a great gift to comedy. Letters were all very well, and mislaid, misdirected, misunderstood letters provided the mainspring of many comedy plots. But the telephone opened up enormous new vistas of confusion. For a start, it gave the stage comedian a perfect feed, who cost nothing and were never threatened to upstage him. You could do an act shouting to someone off stage, but that was limiting to comic variety. Now, with a telephone receiver in your hand, you could talk perfectly normally, you could time your own laughs, and you could create invisible offstage characters at will. Let's hear a classic example of this. Bob Newhart, and in this, he is a West Indies Company's representative in London, talking to Sir Walter Raleigh in the New World.
Well, what is it this time, Walter? You got another winner for us, do you? Tobacco. What's tobacco, Walt? It's a kind of leaf. And you bought 80 tons of it. Let me get this straight now, Walt. You bought 80 tons of leaves? This may come as kind of a surprise to you, Walt, but come fall in England here, we're kind of up to our... It isn't that kind of leaf. What is it, a special food of some kind, is it, Walt? Not exactly. It has a lot of different uses. Like, what are some of the uses, Walt? Are you saying snuff, Walt? What's snuff? You take a pinch of tobacco. And you shove it up your nose. And it makes you sneeze, huh? I imagine it would, Walt, yeah. See, goldenrod seems to do it pretty well all the time. It has some other uses, though. You can chew it. Or put it in a pipe, or you can shred it up and put it on a piece of paper and roll it up. Don't tell me, Walt. Don't tell me. You stick it in your ear, right, Walt? All between your lips. Well, then what do you do to it, Walt? You set fire to it, Waller. Then what do, Walt? You inhale the smoke. You know, Walt, it seems offhand like you could stand in front of your fireplace and have the same thing going for you, you know? See, Walt, we've been a little worried about you, you know. Ever since you put your cape down over that mud, you know. See, Walt, I think you're going to have kind of a tough time selling people on sticking burning leaves in their mouth. It's going very big over there, is it? What's the matter, Walt? You spilt your what? Your coffee. What's coffee, Walt? What is it? That's a drink you make out of beans, huh? That's going over very big there, too, is it? A lot of people have the coffee right after their first cigarette in the morning, huh? Is that what you call a burning leaves, Walt? Cigarettes? Uh-huh. I'll tell you what, Walt. Why don't you send us a boatload of those beans, too? If you can talk people into putting those burning leaves in their mouth, they got to go for those beans, Walt. And listen, Walt. Don't call us. We'll call you. Right, Walt. Come on.
Bob Newhart. Now that we've moved on to the telephone, perhaps we should define our terms. Let's turn for a definition to the Devil's Dictionary of Ambrose Bierce.
Telephone, an invention of the devil which abrogates some of the advantages of making a disagreeable person keep his distance.
And here's Ogden Nash on the subject.
Someone invented the telephone and interrupted the nation's slumbers, ringing wrong but similar numbers.
Mind you, at first the telephone was a daunting piece of apparatus which not everyone understood. A piece from the Oxford Mail.
Urging that workers in remote rural areas should be taught how to use a telephone, Mr. Jack Shingfield, a member of the Essex Agricultural Executive Committee, said that recently when a straw stack caught alight at Little Clacton Farm, the men called the fire brigade by telegram. The firemen arrived too late.
Wouldn't have arrived at all on Sunday, would they? Telegraph poles have always been a problem and the cause of many squabbles among environmentalists. An account of one such from the Times.
Durham Rural District Council's Housing Committee has decided that 5 telephones in houses on a council estate at Witton Gilbert must be removed because the poles are an eyesore. Councillor H. Cooper, a member of the Housing Committee who lives on the council estate but has no home telephone, said, "Unfortunately, we cannot do anything about the poles which spoil the appearance of the estate, but we can have the telephones removed."
Sometimes one is tempted to wonder what happens to the people who take the major decisions in matters relating to the telephone. The men in power in matters, telephonic matters. And unfortunately, we are able to provide the answer from a Freudian misprint in the Boston Traveller.
When telephone directors become obsolete, they're sold to waste paper companies for conversion into pulp. They are torn in two lengthwise, then chopped into small bits in a powerful machine.
Very comforting thought, that, isn't it? But basically, telephones are there for the convenience of the subscriber.
This is a credit card call, please. 752-1527-DK-13. Calling area code 212. The number? 726-5505. Extension 9118. My number? 828-3644. Room 4041. My name? Tui Forsyth. Thank you. Hello. May I speak with Wanda Tennyson, please? Wanda Tennyson. Is this extension 9118? Is this 726-5505? Is this area code 212? I beg your pardon.
Shelley Berman in a reading from the Book of Numbers. Telephone technique is now part of the essential qualifications for a successful executive. There are all kinds of nuances in how the instrument is used. Who speaks to whom first? Whether a call is put through by a secretary? Whether the would-be executive is trapped into speaking to a secretary? Whether or not he's kept waiting? The telephone can be a very humiliating machine. Troy Gordon.
I don't mind being put on hold, but I think they've got me on ignore.
On the other hand, the telephone can give an immense sense of power. Robert Benchley.
There is something about saying okay and hanging up the receiver with a bang that kids a man into feeling that he's just pulled off a big deal, even if he's only called up to find out the correct time.
The trouble is that however impressive you want to be on the phone, you are at the mercy of the machine. A wrong number, an unobtainable tone, a crossed line, they can all ruin your panache. And if you're dealing through the operator, then you're really putting your dignity on the line. The operators hold all the cards. Here's how Marcel Proust described them.
The ever-infuriated servants of the mystery, the umbrageous priestesses of the invisible, the young ladies of the telephone.
Didn't Proust write L'après-midi d'un phone? The telephone operator, you've probably heard it. Let's hear one of these telephone operators at work.
A gracious good afternoon. This is Miss Tomlin of your telephone company. How may I, in all humble servitude, be of assistance? You're trying to reach your husband at his office and keep getting a busy signal. Well, perhaps he's using his instrument. An hour and a half. Well, I will check to see if there is mechanical failure. Mrs. Norman, that phone is in usage. Your husband is making an overseas call to Korea, I believe. Oh, he was stationed there during the war. Must have been lonely for you. Just a minute, let me listen now. Mr. Norman and some woman are talking about your son in Korea. Oh, excuse me, Mrs. Norman, but Bok Choi seems a strange name for a boy from Pleasantville. You say you don't have a son in Korea? Well, that's odd. Mr. Norman does. Mrs. Norman, I am so sorry. Oh, I am so sorry that you had to learn it this way. But we at the phone company do like to keep families in touch. No, Mrs. Norman, listen to Ernestine. Turn off the gas. I'll plug you into his line and you can hear every word the bastard's saying. Listen, oh? Can you hear all right? Oh, did you hear that? The things they do in Korea you wouldn't even think of doing here. No, Mrs. Norman, I've got a great idea. Mrs. Norman, believe me, it's just like a man. They're all animals. Let me call up my cousin. He's a divorce lawyer. We can hook Mr. Norman before he gets off the line. Henry, this is Ernestine. I've got a live one for you. The wife, she's a wonderful woman. I've got her on hold. The husband, I'm not too sure. I think he's with the government. Seems very active in foreign relationships. I'll hook it up so you can get a voice print to use in court. Mrs. Norman, I'm back. Listen, I think we can get you the house, the car, half the business, and the kid in Korea. Mrs. Norman, no, don't thank me, dear. Not nonsense. Don't. It'll be on your next bill.
That was Lily Tomlin. He used to do much the same sort of thing in the television show Laughing. And while we're on the subject, let's hear an epitaph on a telephone girl.
Her friendly number, please, is silent now and gone. The operator has at last been operated on. She's been cut off, and when you ring, no matter how you try, you'll find she's ex-directory, and there'll be no reply.
Oh. Wiping away a fugitive tear. Carry on. Conducting a love affair by telephone isn't to be recommended. It generally leads to unnaturally raised hopes, misunderstandings, and enormous phone bills. Some believe that the telephone is not a medium for conversation at all. and should only be used for the tersest of arrangement-making. Somerset Maugham would have agreed with them.
In heaven, when the blessed use the telephone, they will say what they have to say and not a word besides.
He also made this observation on the uses of the instrument.
Some women can't see a telephone without taking the receiver off.
You know, taking the receiver off is easy enough for those of us familiar with the telephone. But every day, someone who's never seen one before must presumably make his first stumbling attempts to understand the thing. It's presumably for them that all these dialing instructions appear at the beginning of a telephone directory. Do you remember that lovely instruction they used to have? When dialing an all-figure number, be sure to dial all the figures. Now, here's an extract from what is supposed to be Japanese dialing instructions, translated into English for the benefit of tourists.
Employing the right finger next door thumb, go in small holes on clock. Numbers in holes correspond to numbers of number. Move clock with finger to make it retire. When it comes back, make go another number. Very impotent. Do not make go with new number until clock has gone to rest. Otherwise, you will be conjoined with an unsuitable partner. When you have achieved your end, get your finger out.
With those simple instructions in mind, I'm sure you'd feel ready, even for a complicated telephone job, like sending a telegram.
I want to send a telegram, please. Yes. My name is Pratt. Charles Pratt. Yes. 68 Chelcott Square. Yes. And it's going to Miss Edith Harness. Yes. 87 Fitzroy Road. Yes. Right. Well, the telegram. Right. No. Right isn't the telegram, no. I'll say, this is the telegram, and then whatever comes after that is the telegram. Yes. This is the telegram. Are you still there? No, that's not it. No. Well, it's, bless your little... Yes, bless your little, yes. Botty booze. Well, I've never been called upon to spell it, actually. That is your job. Yes. But I'd hazard a guess and say BOTTIBOOES. But I don't think that the last E is statutory. No. Well, it's a diminutive of bottom, really, isn't it? No, she hasn't got a diminutive bottom. That's really the joke. Yes. So, there's your little body boots. Then I want to sign it Goody Goody Gumdrops. GG Gumdrops would be cheaper. It sounds rather absurd, really, doesn't it? I don't really want to save a shilling simply in order to sign absurd. No, Goody Goody Gumdrops in full, yes. And then I want to end up Norwich. Yes. Well, it's an epigrammatic way of saying, knickers off ready when I come home. Well, it's the initial letters, you see, of each word. Yes. I know knickers is spelt with a K. I did go to Oxford. That was one of the first things they taught us. Yes. And in a perfect world, I agree, it would be courage. But it doesn't have quite the same idiomatic force, I think, as Norwich, does it? Burma. No, I hadn't come across that. What's that? Be upstairs ready, my angel. Well, it's very nice. I like it. But I think it would be rather inappropriate in this case because Miss Harness lives in a basement flat. If she was upstairs ready, she would in fact be in the flat of the Irish labourer who lives upstairs. Yes, and we don't want that, do we? Oh, I don't think Norwich is obscene, no. Oh, surely not, no. Well, I mean, what about the Bishop of Norwich? I mean, when he signs his letters Cyril Norwich, does he mean Cyril Norwich, or does he mean Cyril knickers off ready when I come home? We just don't know. No. 12 words of conventional greeting would be cheaper. Yes, but I don't somehow think that keep your chin up, every cloud has a silver lining quite mirrors my thought. No. But thank you all the same. Goodbye.
That was... yes. Worth a round of applause, if anything is. That was Alan Bennett, of course. Let's conclude with a little poem by Eleanor Bron, entitled No Answer.
I waited for the phone to ring, and when at last it didn't, I knew it was you.
From Alfred and me, goodbye.
Hello?
Goodbye.
Hello? Hello?
Goodbye.
Hello?
Goodbye.
Hello?
Goodbye. Hello? Hello?
Goodbye.
Hello, Alfred, bye. Goodbye. Are you there?
Frank Muir Goes Into the Post Office was produced by Simon Brett.